Thank you again for everyone joining us today. Welcome to the marketing call by Perkins Coie Trust Company. My name is Chris Walcott. I'm the Chief Trust Officer, and I will be helping moderate the call. We realize there's a lot going on right now, and we hope this finds you and your families well. With the volatility in the markets, the purpose of the call today is to provide the trust company's perspective and approach to taking approaches taken to manage risk within portfolios in anticipation of various market conditions. For those of you not met him directly, Andrew Ellefson, the Chief Investment Officer for Perkins Coie Trust Company, will be leading the call. To facilitate the call, in light of the number of people participating, everyone is in listen-only mode. Following Andrew's message, there will be a Q&A session to accommodate as many questions as possible as we look to wrap up the call around 2:15 today. If you have questions and to submit a question, please email your questions to pctcinvestments@perkinscoie.com. That email address was also in the invites that we sent via email on Friday and this morning. There are already several questions that have been received over the weekend, and we will do our best to address them. Perkins Coie Trust Company is here to serve you, so please don't hesitate to reach out to us directly with any specific questions you may have. With that, I would like to introduce Andrew Ellefson.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you all for joining this afternoon. I know the market uncertainty certainly has a lot of us concerned, and I hope to address a number of those concerns today. But first and foremost, our thoughts are with the frontline healthcare workers and those afflicted with the virus. Obviously, they have a uphill battle here to fight, and we wish them all well. So the structure for this discussion this morning, ideally, you all are very concerned about your portfolios, and the portfolios are reacting strongly to the markets. The markets are looking at the economy for some indication of what's about to happen, and the economy is looking to the virus to see what's about to happen. So we'll tackle those in reverse order, starting at the top with the virus and then talking about the economy, the markets, and ultimately your portfolios. With regard to the first three, there's certainly lots of uncertainty, and the markets do hate uncertainty, but they also are very efficient at pricing in uncertainty. And they tend to rally very strongly as certainty is restored. So we'll cover this topic a little bit more as we go on. But I do want to point out that everything discussed today is probably priced into the markets. So although we're going to cover some topics that might sound scary, the markets are already taking this into account. So first and foremost, don't react strongly to anything you hear today. A little bit of background for myself. I have been in the investment industry since, I've been doing financial services since 1997, managing portfolios since 2001. So this is first and foremost not my first pandemic. In fact, this is my fifth pandemic as I was managing international portfolios at the time. I have lived through swine flu, SARS, MERS, and Ebola now. And in fact, a member of my family had swine flu. So I do take these very seriously. And another thing to keep in mind is this is also not my first bear market. This is ultimately my fourth bear market now. And while not any bear market is the same, they all have very familiar characteristics to them. And most importantly, the right call every time in every bear market has been to remain fully invested at all times, as you cannot predict the bottom of these events. They tend to turn around quite sharply and quite quickly. I discussed that a little bit in a communication we sent out last week on March 9th, which happened to be the 11th anniversary to the day of the bottom of the 2008 market crisis. So again, I can't stress enough, you will not get the timing of the market right, but markets have recovered every time and it has paid to remain fully invested. So let's start by talking about the virus. And strangely enough, we actually have almost the most certainty about this of the four topics, despite the overall uncertainty about the virus. But we do have very clear and consistent models for things like the morbidity and mortality of this virus. So we have a clear model for what the infection rate looks like going forward. So, you know, the key to that is left unchecked, it tends to double every week. Which poses a challenge to our healthcare system. Capacity can very quickly become overwhelmed. So for example, in the US, we have about 800,000 hospital beds currently, and about 300,000 of those are unoccupied at the moment. But with an infection rate of just 2% of the US population, and about 5% of those requiring hospital care, we would very quickly overrun the hospital's capacity. So that is why it is very critical that we all take into consideration social distancing and other precautions that the CDC and the World Health Organization have advised us of. So I would encourage you all to continue washing your hands and practicing social distancing. That said, there is good news. There are two models for success in how this virus can be beat, and we have those operating today in two countries. So let's take a look at those very quickly. First and foremost, we had China, which was the epicenter of the virus breakout. China has an authoritarian government, and they can take some pretty draconian measures, and in fact, they did. So they instituted isolation measures in the affected regions, and they instituted countrywide social distancing, coincidentally during a market holiday, which helped with the economy already being widely shut down. But they also instituted mass ramps up of hospital capacity, and so China today is experiencing single-digit new infection rates, so a very extraordinarily low new infection rate. So that is one model for conquering this virus. South Korea is the second successful model we've seen already, just 3 months into this event. They instituted mass testing. You've all seen the drive-through testing that they've instituted. And they have instituted target isolation of various neighborhoods and populations that have infections in them, and electronic tracking of those patients so they can alert other people in the vicinity of patients that they may have been exposed. So that has worked extraordinarily well and has slowed the infection rate in South Korea very meaningfully. Italy has taken a different tact. They'd use a target isolation and then a countrywide isolation, and we have yet to see whether that will be effective or not. Generally, there's a two-week lag to the broad-based isolation and social distancing. So we are coming into the period when we should see the infection rate in Italy slow pretty meaningfully. The U.S. currently is exercising some social distancing, particularly in affected regions, of which I live in one, as well as some testing, particularly if you have experienced contact with somebody who has an infection or exhibit signs of an infection yourself. But frankly, we need more of both of those. We need more social distancing and more testing to prevent a human health crisis. So we're a little bit behind the curve in the U.S., but to be honest with you, we're waking up quite quickly. And I do believe in the U.S.'s capacity to tackle large and complex issues better than almost anybody else in the world. So I am optimistic on how quickly we're going to get our testing up and running, as well as sort of coming together to prevent the further spread of this virus. Unfortunately, the cure to the virus is to shut down parts of the economy. So let's turn our attention to the economic impact. And to be honest with you, in this discussion, that's where I have the most uncertainty. As I said at the beginning of this, recessions and downturns have similarities, but they absolutely, this one is very unique. So we entered 2020 in very good economic standing. We had low unemployment, we had stable consumption, good housing data, and although we had industrial production recession last year, industrial production had been coming back fairly significantly. So most importantly, this economic downturn does not have any endogenous risks, so internally created risks. Historically, if you look back over recessions, generally there's an overcapacity built up or some irrational behavior that has caused the problem, and we don't have that this time. And the problem with endogenous risks and these overcapacities is that they take a really long time to get rid of. So if you think about 2008, there was too much housing debt in the market. In 2000, there was too much investment in technology and a lot of misallocated investments. And so those take a long time to work out. This is an entirely exogenous shock. The virus is an exogenous shock. And the thing with exogenous shocks is once they have abated, markets are historically very swift to recover from it, and the economies are very swift to recover from them as well. So that's a little bit of good news for this particular event. So what are we seeing? In 1Q, we will see economic damage. That's undoubted. We'll see an impact on GDP. We'll see an impact on employment as a lot of restaurants and service facilities close over the weekend. And companies are already guiding to lower earnings for the first quarter. We actually got our first glimpse of what the economy looks like in China this morning. Consumption was down 20% during the first quarter. Industrial production fell 13%, and their unemployment rate did tick up about one full percentage point. So we're starting to be able to model in what the economic impact looks like. And I opened this discussion talking about uncertainties. And as we remove those uncertainties, markets tend to take comfort in that. So data is good. The 2Q, second quarter, will likely be a little bit worse than the first quarter. That is the beginning, essentially, of the 6 to 8 week social distancing period in the U.S. A lot of businesses will be closed for the next few weeks. Supply chains will be tested. Service economy will suffer fairly significantly. And then we have the additional challenge in the energy sector as OPEC has begun fighting for market share. Russia and Saudi Arabia essentially couldn't come to an agreement about who could produce certain amounts of oil, and they both decided to start pumping fairly excessively. So we have an increased supply of oil during a period in which we have a decreased demand. So the price of oil is collapsing fairly quickly. Fortunately, in our portfolios, we remain underweight energy generally as it faces a structural headwind, and we don't see any reason to reverse that underweight. Elsewhere in the economy, I mean, the way to mend the economy due to this virus is essentially massive quantities of stimulus. And there's two components to stimulus. There's monetary stimulus and there's fiscal stimulus. Over the weekend, we actually got a fairly aggressive monetary stimulus package. So we saw $700 billion of quantitative easing announced by the Federal Reserve. And they also surprised the market and dropped rates to 0% ahead of their meeting later this week. Both of those things do almost nothing, obviously, to prevent the further spread of virus. But what they do is they prop up a financial system that is afraid. They learned their lesson in 2008. They saw how banks stopped lending to each other even, and they are heading off any damage that might be caused by that activity. And so that was an incredibly positive move, although it scared the markets a little bit this morning, because it is one of the two components we need to solve this economic damage. The second component, obviously, is fiscal stimulus, and that is required. That requires Congress to approve. We saw the first of the fiscal bills passed through the House late last week. It's in the Senate this morning, and I haven't seen the latest discussion on it. I suspect it's happening as we're on the call here. But it's widely expected to pass this week at some point with minor amendments. That's a first step. We are likely to see additional steps of fiscal stimulus in the future, with some estimates being that we need between $200 billion and up to $1 trillion of fiscal stimulus. And that can come in a number of packages, which we can circle back and discuss. But one additional measure that went into effect late last week was the state of emergency. So that's an important step as well. That reduces red tape required to get funding out to state and local governments so they can institute a response on the ground in their jurisdictions. So that's a positive move. Let's turn our attention a little bit towards the markets here, which have reacted fairly strongly to the uncertainty, certainly, and the economic damage that this virus has caused. As I open the conversation, you know, markets are forward-looking, but they hate uncertainty. And the current uncertainty is fairly unprecedented. I mean, we don't understand fully the virus morbidity, mortality. We don't fully understand the healthcare capacity requirements. We're evaluating the economic damage at the moment. We're evaluating damage to companies, to their balance sheets, to their cash flows. And the municipal market is evaluating the reduction in receipts for tax collection. We also don't know the response at this point. So all of that uncertainty is currently priced into the market. We've seen some extreme moves in the market, and that has been basically accumulated declines based on the uncertainty. As these uncertainties are removed, markets will begin to price assets more appropriately. And we have a couple of examples of that over the last couple of weeks. The German fiscal stimulus last Friday, they announced a $600 billion package to prop up their economy. And global markets rallied very strongly. They were up about 6% just on that announcement and another 3% after our government started discussing fiscal stimulus. So, and then about 2 weeks ago, the Fed injected liquidity into the overnight repo rate, and the market rallied about 4%. So we are seeing markets react strongly to stimulus, which is a good sign. The three main constituents that we need to provide certainty on: fiscal certainty, monetary certainty, and health services certainty. As I said, the markets will begin to return to normal as we get those three certainties in place. And you know, the question is then, what does that look like? What does the market look like as it gains certainty? So if you look at the market returns over the last 30 years, we have averaged a 7.3% annualized return. And that includes those periods of the tech bust, the Great Recession, the Greek debt crisis, and now the beginning of the coronavirus. That's through yesterday's data. So good or bad economy, you have averaged a 7.3% return in the equity markets over the last 30 years. And that's the case for staying fully invested. If you had missed just the five best days over the last 30 years, your annualized return falls from 7.3 down to 5.5%. And that is the strongest case I've ever seen for not trying to time the market. The third best day in the last 30 years occurred last Friday. If you miss that day, it's going to impact your returns. Four of the best 50 days in the last 30 years happened in March of this year. So while the red markets and the decline days are the scary ones, we can't forget that we've had some extremely strong rallies within those declines. So again, reiterating, stay fully invested. More importantly, the average bull market after a bear market rises 183% over the last 100 years. So markets will return, and that's my main message to you. They will normalize eventually. We will get through this, and they will return to a resumption of growth. Last but not least, the current market is priced essentially for a recession at this point. It is not expensive, even if you start discounting earnings and assuming a lower growth rate or even a recession at this point. The markets are not expensive. And so we really are starting to see some opportunities open up, particularly in high quality companies that we look for in your portfolios that have strong balance sheets and continue to pay dividends and do buybacks. So with that, I'm going to turn to discussing portfolios and overall Perkins Coie Trust Company and how we think about risk and manage portfolios. You may think of us as your investment manager, but I would emphasize and I reiterate to my team that we are also risk managers and think about risks in everything that we do to manage those risks. And risk management really starts very early on in the process with you. It's knowing you, the clients, and understanding your individual risks. And then we move into the investment objectives, which are tailored to your risk tolerance and your investment horizon. We think about risk as we do allocations within those investment objectives. They are designed to diversify across risk asset classes, across geographies, across sectors, across industries, and across volatilities and return potentials as well. So a diversified portfolio spreads your risk out and makes you not susceptible to any one major risk. Certainly not last or least, security selection. We look to evaluate managers based on historical performance, tenure, diversification, and other risk criteria. And we really do take a critical eye to those managers we're using in your portfolios and have conversations with them regularly just to discuss how they are managing their risks in their portfolios. Within our core equity portfolio, roughly 50 U.S. Large cap equity names, we have recently done a balance sheet review to make sure they are all in solid financial footing. And moreover, their ability to continue to pay the dividends that they have announced and discussed with the market. And we've done an analysis about their capacity to do additional buybacks should they see an attractive price on their own stock. So that's a potential return driver that will begin to creep into the market as companies get through their first quarter earnings and discuss buying back their own shares. So sort of to wrap things up, we are not market timers. We believe in being fully invested through the market cycle with diverse investments in pragmatic allocations with a strategic investment in mind. That doesn't mean we don't do anything in these market environments. You know, last year, as we looked across the investment universe, we began removing risk from portfolios based on valuations. We reduced corporate credit in most portfolios. We added a lot to government-backed securities, particularly Ginnie Mae mortgage-backed securities. We began increasing allocations to alternative investments such as real estate and infrastructure, and we maintained cash positions. At the beginning of this year, after the incredible rally we had in 2019, we had discussions internally and discussed valuations of various asset classes in the markets, and came to the conclusion that things were fairly elevated, and began setting aside cash in portfolios at the margin just to be prepared for any pullback in the market. I couldn't possibly have predicted this, but it is certainly opening up opportunities, as I said. So I said, stay the course. Stay the course doesn't mean do nothing. You know, studies prove time and time again that market sell-offs are the absolute best time to start rebalancing your portfolio to your strategic allocations. So, you know, I would encourage people on the phone, and if you have any questions, to reach out to our team. And most importantly, to stay the course, to stay fully invested, to tune out the noise and to focus on your long-term goals and let the benefits of that diversification and that long-term investing play out through this market cycle. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Chris Walcott, who I think has been receiving some questions while we've been on the line here. If you do have questions, feel free to email them to pctcinvestments@perkinscoie.com. We have a number of team members standing by to receive those questions and make sure they get read out over the conference call here. And if we don't get to your question, we will try and circle back with you outside of this call and address your concerns.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. First question, how much of what is happening in the market is attributable to artificial factors, algorithmic momentum, volatility, trading-based strategies rather than economic fundamentals? And then along with that, and how should an ordinary investor deal with a market that may, to a material extent, be disconnected from economic fundamentals?
Okay, that's a good question, and it's actually really topical today. So it's hard to quantify how much of the market moves are algorithmic or programmatic trading. We do know that it is fairly meaningful on a very short horizon, which is why you see the S&P 500 triggers those circuit breakers. When the market trades down more than 7%, it basically turns off the market for a 15-minute breather. And that's not trying to get humans to breathe, that's trying to get the machines to stop reacting to immediate data. So a lot of some of the intraday moves is absolutely driven by that algorithmic trading and that high-frequency trading. The antidote to that, to be honest with you, is long-term investing. I cannot beat a machine in the nanosecond time frame. I certainly can't beat a machine on a 15-minute time frame. But machines tend to break down, and their models tend to break down and not work particularly well once you get out to a one-year horizon. And certainly over a five-year horizon, they're actually really bad at picking stocks and allocating assets. So the antidote is long-term investing and sort of tuning out that noise.
Another question. And I know we're not through this correction, but how does, you know, where we are so far with this correction compare to previous episodes of market volatility?
Sure. Again, every episode is going to be a little bit different, but they all have sort of similar elements. And our team has been sort of looking back over those elements and trying to assess where we are. The average bear market is down between 23% and 27%, and I don't remember the exact figure, but we are well within that range currently. Obviously, 2008 was a little bit worse, and the Great Depression was significantly worse. But you know, eventually, what you see in every bear market is that there comes a time when you get capitulation selling and fear selling, which I think we got a good dose of today, which is sort of that irrational get me out of the market selling. And those people tend to be the last ones who sell before value buyers start seeing value in the market and moving fairly meaningfully into the market. I'm not making a call that we're at the bottom of this. There's still a lot of uncertainty that needs to be worked out. But you are starting to see some of the normal behaviors of a bear market in the process of bottoming.
would now be a good time to invest in riskier investment grade bonds? Or do you have any major concerns about the credit sphere?
Investment grade bonds. Okay, that's going to be a unique category. There had been concerns percolating through most of 2018 and 19, frankly. This is a time in my life when I was actually a corporate bond portfolio manager. So I was acutely attuned to these concerns, but that too much of the market had moved towards a triple B rating as rated by the S&P credit rating service and the Moody's credit rating service, because essentially there wasn't any penalty for being a bad credit as long as you were an investment grade credit. And triple B is about as low as you can go in investment grade credit. So Microsoft, with its A rating, was paying just a little bit less than every other company that had a triple B rating. So essentially, companies saw the writing on the wall. They said there's no penalty for being a low credit and taking out more debt. So they did. A lot of companies moved towards that triple B rating, and that stretched a lot of balance sheets. So in 2019, a lot of the market was concerned with, you know, is there a triple B bond apocalypse coming? And are a lot of these corporate credit sheets, balance sheets going to be downgraded into high yield territory, essentially? I would say this event is probably going to precipitate a number of downgrades in corporate balance sheets. That doesn't mean bankruptcies. That just means that they are a riskier entity to lend to, and that they should and will pay higher interest rates to borrow money. Good news is they were mostly borrowing that money to buy back their own shares. So we, as an investment group, tend not to invest in those types of companies. We tend to look for very solid balance sheets and very good franchises that have long-term growth potential. So I would actually dissuade you from buying triple B bonds specifically. With a couple of caveats, I do think there's going to be an opportunity in the not too distant horizon for high yield debt to be added to portfolios. The high yield market is overweight to the energy sector, and energy balance sheets have been not only extremely stretched, but now they're being beat up by the low oil price and the lack of cash flow from that. So once that sort of works itself through the market, there's going to be a really interesting opportunity in high yield debt. I would say it is probably a good time to add really high quality credits to your portfolio, your corporate bond portfolio, because they've been punished almost as much as the bad quality credits. So you can buy debt from Microsoft or Apple or some of these good, really good companies with extremely strong balance sheets, and put them in your portfolio and earn a healthy return over the next few years.
What is a good hedge in the current market?
I think you'll see a lot of people turn towards gold as a hedge. And I don't believe in gold as a good diversifier generally. And I'll tell you why. It's I don't believe in gold as an investment. It serves as an insurance policy, which is essentially, I think things are about to get a lot worse and I want to know how much money I'm going to have, but so does US dollar cash, right? So gold doesn't really serve a function in your portfolio above and beyond cash, unless you think the financial market is going to, system is going to collapse entirely, in which case we have a lot bigger problems. And I absolutely do not believe that. A good hedge in this market environment is first and foremost, government bonds, and you've seen those securities appreciate in value very meaningfully during March. The interest rates paid on U.S. government debt have fallen to extremely low levels, and the price of those instruments has gone up significantly. But another good hedge is to move into alternative assets like we did last year. So real estate is generally considered a very non-correlated asset to U.S. equities, and it approximates some of the characteristics of bonds over time. And then alternative investments tend to be an interesting asset class. Infrastructure assets tend to be an interesting asset class where you can get a sort of non-correlated return in essentially what's a monopoly business. You know, you talk about airports or ports. You know, they may experience some some difficulties with air travel in this environment, but over time, they own some really interesting assets that are non-correlated to equity returns, and they tend to trade quite differently from equity markets. So the crux of the story is diversify into a number of asset classes, but there is no, you know, the classic 60-40 bond and equity portfolio is your best hedge through almost all market cycles.
Another question. Any advice you would recommend for someone who is expecting to retire in the next few years?
So that's sort of a unique case that it's harder to follow my advice, which is, you know, long-term investing and stay the course. Presumably, we've been having conversations with you along the way about your investment objective and your allocations over time and moving those into more conservative allocations ultimately. If you are planning on retiring in the next few years, you cannot control what the markets are going to do. You certainly can't control what the economy is going to do, and you can't control what this virus is going to mean for the world. The one thing you can control is your spending levels. So if you do have concerns about the next few years, that is the most immediate thing that you can control. As I said, we have these diversified portfolios so that we can sort of weather these environments, even on a 1 to 2 year horizon. So, you know, if you do have explicit concerns, give us a call. Let's talk through them. We can run models. We can run analysis of what your retirement program looks like, and hopefully put you at ease.
Last question it looks like we have here. What opportunities or risks do we foresee within the volatile environment?
Opportunities or risks?
This volatile environment.
The risks are numerous and probably too numerous to discuss here. But there, you know, if I'm thinking about individual companies, there are a lot of companies that are going to experience risks that are hard to quantify currently. So I love airlines as an investment. I don't currently own any in the portfolio, but I think, you know, that industry has been consolidating for 20 odd years, and consolidation has unanimously led to higher returns. So once we have more certainty about what the airline's future looks like, and it sounds like there was a discussion today about a $50 billion bailout package, I would consider airlines an extremely interesting investment opportunity for the next few years. The same with the cruise lines. They operate an incredible business with enormous cash returns to investors. But that comes with risks. And this, you know, the coronavirus is not the first risk they've faced. I mean, many people remember the images of the Carnival Cruise Lines boat that was overturned in the Italian Bay a few years ago. But that, you know, these stocks are down more than 50% at this point. So if you think the company is only worth half of what it was 3 months ago, then maybe it's priced appropriately, but I don't believe that. They still own the same amount of assets. They just are having an impact on their cash flows this year. And that's sort of the key. You're not buying a company for its cash flows this year. You're buying it for the long term. So if you can make a reasonable case that a company will return to a normal cash flow environment at some point in the future, there's a lot of really good opportunities in the market. Personally, you know, my kids have long-term investment horizons, and so I'm evaluating a lot of the really high-quality companies that have been taken down with this market, along with some of the low-quality companies. So, you know, things like Apple or Google or, you know, things that can be in their portfolio for 15 to 20 years. Yeah, there really are quite a few opportunities opening up at this point.
Great. Well, Andrew, thank you. For everyone on the call, again, we just are grateful you joined us for this time. And if there are any other questions that you might have, you can reach out to us directly. We're here to answer those and make sure that you get the answers that you need for personal decisions that you have to make. So we're here. You know how to reach us. We appreciate your time on this call. And with that, we'll stop recording, and we'll talk to you soon. Have a great day.